Building a legacy. Building a legacy. In our first year of marriage, we were living in Orpington, settling into the rhythm of weekday routines. Sally working in banking and me at my parents' factory. But the weekends were where the real energy of our lives pulsed. Saturdays started early. I'd drop Sally at her stall at Inverness Street Market in Camden, help her set up, then head over to Hoxton Street Market, where I traded until early afternoon. After packing up, I'd return to Camden to help Sally close her stall. Our Saturdays often ended with a reward, sometimes a nice dinner, other times dancing until the early hours at La Trek in Beckenham. Then, without sleep, we'd head straight to Petticoat Lane Market for Sunday trading. As casual traders without a permanent pitch, we had to arrive before dawn, register with the market inspector, and hope a regular didn't show so we could grab a spot. We'd paid a £100 deposit to Tower Hamlets Council, and £12.50 was deducted every time we got a pitch. If the balance dropped below £50, we were out of the game. Some weeks, despite the early mornings and long hours, we went home empty-handed. That all changed when I secured a permanent pitch at the new market in Earl's Court Exhibition Center. It was indoors during winter in the underground car park and moved outdoors in summer. Suddenly, Sundays became steady and worthwhile. Sally finally had a day to herself. She'd relax at home, potter around, and cook us a proper roast dinner. I liked knowing she was warm and content in Orpington while I worked the crowds. But this particular Sunday was different. Before I left for the market, Sally made one thing clear. Be home as soon as you can. We're going to visit Nikki, and I want you to meet her new boyfriend. Nikki wasn't just any friend. She was Sally's best friend, the daughter of her dad's business partner. When Sally had moved down from Goole to live with her dad and stepmom, it was Nikki who took her under her wing. Over the years, we'd grown close too. As our families grew, Nikki with three daughters and us with three sons, our kids had become like cousins. So with Sally's request fresh in my mind, I tried to make quick work of the day at Earl's Court. Of course, the BMW guy was at it again. He showed up as usual and blocked everyone's access to the area around his stall. On this particular day, he pulled into the access road and once again completely shut everyone out. No one could get through until he'd finished unloading and setting up, and of course, he took his sweet time packing up at the end of the day. I was absolutely fuming. When I finally got home, I gave Sally the full dramatic recount of the BMW guy's antics. Every stomp, every slam door, every scowl. She was in stitches. She laughed so hard, she nearly choked on her tea. Later that evening, we drove out to Clacton to visit Nikki. She'd been so keen for us to meet her new boyfriend and had arranged the evening just for that. And even after the chaos of the day, we were glad we made it, because some introductions have a way of changing everything. When the door swung open, I nearly dropped the bottle of wine I was holding. Standing there, like some smug apparition conjured straight from my rant an hour earlier, was him, the same arrogant market trader with the BMW who had blocked everyone at Earl's Court that morning. The man I'd spent all afternoon cursing, mimicking, and generally tearing to shreds for Sally's entertainment. I stared. My jaw might have hit the floor. I turned slowly to Sally, wide-eyed and blurted, "That's him. That's the bloke I told you about. The one with the bloody BMW. But that wasn't even the weirdest part. He wasn't just standing there like a normal person. No. He leaned against the doorway as if the world belonged to him, wrapped in a plush burgundy dressing gown that seemed more Woolworth's bargain bin than Playboy Mansion chic. A smug little grin played at his lips, and around his neck, God knows why, hung a chunky gold chain with Madeline spelled out in gaudy letters. But it was the hair that truly stole the show. That mullet, short and tidy on top, but tumbling into a rebellious cascade at the back, looked like a time traveler had plucked it straight out of a future Bon Jovi video and dropped it into this flat in Clacton. The whole picture was so gloriously ridiculous that Sally and I couldn't help ourselves. We just dissolved into laughter. What else could we possibly do? From that ridiculous moment, an unlikely friendship began to grow. His name was Sonny. Sonny, the mullet-haired, dressing-gown-wearing rogue, turned out to be as sharp as he was eccentric. One Sunday morning, not long after we met, I was struck down by a stomach bug. I had to bolt for the toilet mid-setup at the market, leaving my entire stall in chaos. Boxes unopened, skirts unpriced, nothing ready. When I came back, bleary-eyed and expecting disaster, Sonny handed me nearly 300 pounds in cash with a cheeky grin. "I sorted your skirts, mate," he said. "Tourists couldn't get enough of them." Apparently, he'd sold dozens of them, on the fly, without labels, by improvising prices and using his signature flair. He'd priced the £5.99 skirts at £10.99, then offered a bulk discount at £8.99 each if they bought three or more. Tourists lapped it up, thinking they were haggling their way into a great deal. And Sonny had a method. He explained it to me later with the confidence of a seasoned street philosopher. Tourists, he said, live for the hustle. They want to haggle, so he always set a high sticker price and then generously dropped it right in front of them for dramatic effect. Locals, though, different game. "If you tag it at £10.99, he told me, "a Brit assumes that's the honest price and just buys it, no questions asked." That dual strategy, performance pricing for tourists, no-nonsense tags for locals, completely changed how I approach selling. And though I never quite mastered the mullet or the dressing gown, I've carried that lesson with me ever since. While Sally continued her demanding job in the city as a Eurobond settlements clerk at E.F. Hutton, I spent my days at my parents' factory, working as a finisher, packing and delivering completed dockets to clients like Chelsea Girl in Hanger Lane, Northwest London, and McKay's, headquartered far up in Paisley, Scotland. Delivery days were always intense. My dad insisted on packing the van to bursting, determined to make every mile count. We'd work well into the night, squeezing in every last box until the back doors barely shut. Scotland was the worst of them all. He always booked the drop-off for first thing in the morning, 9 a.m. sharp, yet we'd still be loading the van at 11 p.m. the night before. That meant one thing, a brutal, sleepless overnight drive through the heart of the UK. On this particular trip, our van was in for servicing. We hired a one-way rental from Kenning Van Hire. I was already running on fumes when I climbed into the driver's seat, staring down 400-plus miles of blacktop. But I had no choice. Missing the slot at McKay's would mean hours of waiting. No one had time for that. Fueled by caffeine and determination, I set off into the night, the dashboard clock ticking louder in my mind than the engine. If I kept an average of 60 miles per hour, I could make it in 7 hours, enough time for a couple of pit stops to top up fuel and slam down coffee. I couldn't afford to nap, not even for an hour. I didn't trust myself to wake up. For a while, everything went like clockwork. Up the M1, then onto the M6, Birmingham, Manchester, Parker, Kendal, Carlisle. I passed the Scottish border, two more coffees, but fatigue was creeping in, like a shadow slowly overtaking the rearview mirror. Then, just 50 miles from Glasgow, it happened. My body shut down. I fell asleep at the wheel. At 70 miles per hour, the van suddenly swerved, cutting across three lanes of empty motorway in the pale dawn light. By some miracle, there was no traffic, no one else to crash into. But I wasn't so lucky. The van slammed into the central reservation with a horrible metal-on-metal shriek. I jolted awake to chaos, the steering wheel bucking in my hands, the side of the van grinding along the barrier like a slow-motion wreck. Heart pounding, I somehow managed to wrestle the van off the barrier and pull into a service station ASAP. I stepped out, legs shaking, and surveyed the damage. It was catastrophic. The near side wing crushed, the driver's door caved in, the rear panel shredded. I stared at the wreckage and muttered, "Shit." My dad was going to kill me, but I didn't have time to panic. The van was still drivable, just barely. I made it to McKay's on time. The lads unloading the goods had a laugh at the state of the van, but I forced a grin and shrugged it off. Then came the next problem, returning the van to Kenning's Glasgow branch. Thinking fast, I filled the tank right to the brim, well above the quarter I was required to return it with, and parked as tightly as possible against a wall, hiding the destroyed side from view. Climbing awkwardly out of the passenger door, I strolled into reception and handed over the keys with forced nonchalance. "I accidentally overfilled the tank," I said, gesturing to the paperwork. "Only needed to bring it back with a quarter." The guy behind the counter barely looked up. "Tough luck," he said, shrugging. "We'll process your refund soon. Thanks for returning the van." I nodded, numb, and walked out like a man heading for the gallows. On the train back to London, my thoughts raced. The van was a write-off. The damage was glaring. Surely they'd spot it, call my dad, and demand compensation. The deposit was gone. I was sure of it. But what terrified me wasn't the money. It was facing my dad. I arrived home just in time for a dinner Sally had prepared, but I was miles away, haunted by what was coming the next day. I barely touched my food, lost in the loop of what-if scenarios playing in my head. The next morning, I braced for impact and drove to the factory. My dad was already there, sorting through papers like any other day. I waited and waited. Nothing. No explosion, no fury, not a single word. I didn't say a thing either, not out of relief, but out of disbelief. Had Kennings missed the damage? Had they just claimed it on insurance? Or had they called my dad and he paid the price without saying a word? I believe it was the latter. It reminded me of something that happened when I was 18. I'd just passed my test. My dad gave me an Escort 1.6-liter estate so I could run deliveries. One night I crashed it, wrote it off. I was shattered with guilt. But all he asked was, "Are you all right?" I swore I'd never drive again. That weekend, he took me to the factory. At 10 a.m. during the tea break, he said, "Come with me." We drove to a Toyota dealership. Waiting there for me was a brand new fire engine red Toyota Celica. He had already bought it. Later, my mom told me something I never forgot. "Your dad loves you. Cars can be replaced. You can't. Making a big fuss after the fact is pointless." That was my dad. And I truly believe that's exactly what happened with the van. We were married on Friday, August 13th, 1983, and spent our honeymoon in Magaluf, Majorca. It was a lively, sun-drenched week that took an unexpected but memorable turn when we met two young deaf men who were also holidaying there. Something about them drew both Sally and me in. We quickly struck up a friendship, hired a Jeep, and ended up spending most of the week together. We picked up bits of sign language as we went, clumsy at first, but full of laughter and patience. It might have been our honeymoon, but we found genuine joy in connecting with these two. The way their faces lit up when met with empathy and kindness stayed with us. We didn't see their disabilities, only their abilities, their humor, and their warmth. I still remember our hotel room number, 267, because I'd make a point of asking for the key in Spanish every day, 267. Funny how some things just stick with you. That Christmas, Sally surprised me with my dream hi-fi system, a Bang & Olufsen 5000 Beos system paired with a set of Red Lion speakers. We had spent hours at Harrods exploring the different audio setups, and when we wandered into the B&O studio, we were mesmerized by the crisp, immersive sound. Unbeknownst to me, Sally had already made up her mind. This was what she was going to get me. We both loved music, and between us, we had a great vinyl collection. That Christmas, we spent the day at home, basking in the rich sound of our new system. As the new year approached, we traveled up to Goole to spend New Year's with Sally's mom, Barbara, and her partner, John. On January 2nd, 1984, as we were getting ready to drive back home, we pulled into the local Ford dealership to top up on petrol. While standing at the pump, something inside the showroom caught my eye. A brand new silver-gray Ford Escort 1.6i convertible. It sparkled under the showroom lights, decked out with helium balloons and a bold red ribbon. I couldn't look away. Sally's birthday was just 11 days away on January 13th, and suddenly I knew. This wasn't just a car. It was the birthday present. Back in Orpington, I wasted no time. I called the dealership the next day and asked if they'd take my Toyota Celica in part exchange. After some negotiation, we sealed the deal. Finance sorted, plans in motion, and with Sally completely unaware, my brother Alkin and I headed back to Goole to collect the car. The dealership, clearly enjoying the secrecy, let me keep the ribbon and balloons for the full effect. I picked up a huge happy birthday card, and we made the long journey home with the top down, two brothers on a covert mission. When we arrived back in Orpington, I parked the Escort outside the house while Sally still thought I was at work. Then came the moment. She stepped outside and froze. Her face lit up with disbelief, joy, and something close to awe. It was everything I had hoped for. The hug she gave me was worth every mile traveled. The market days were good to us. We loved it. The buzz, the rhythm, the way we moved in sync. But more than that, we loved being together. at my mom and dad's factory in Whitechapel, grafting through the noise and chaos. Sally would call me endlessly from her office in the city, her voice bright and impatient. I'd drop everything, jump in the car, and head over for one of our now trademark long lunches. I couldn't believe how much time city folk could stretch out over a salad and a glass of wine. Most mornings, I'd drive her into work. We'd stop for a McDonald's breakfast, sausage and egg muffins, hash browns, extra ketchup. Then I'd drop her near the bank and cruise back to Turner Street to the familiar clatter of the factory floor. Come lunchtime, I'd head back out, meet Sally again, then return to Whitechapel where my mum, God love her, had cooked and brought in a full meal for me. I couldn't say no. She'd beam with pride as she watched me eat. I didn't have the heart to tell her I was already stuffed, so I'd eat again. Evenings were for unwinding. Our favorite spot? Grunt's, a little restaurant tucked away in Maiden Lane, Covent Garden. One night in particular stands out. I'd already eaten 3 times that day. Breakfast with Sally, lunch with her again, a second lunch with my mum's home cooking, and then a deep pan pizza at Grunt's, just to round it off. As we left the restaurant, the food finally won. I doubled over and puked all over the wrought iron railings outside. A couple just about to walk in stopped in their tracks, turned around, and walked off. If the food made someone throw up on the doorstep, they clearly wanted no part of it. When I told Sally later why I'd been sick, that my mum had overfed me and I hadn't the guts to refuse, she burst into hysterics. That was her way, always laughing. Especially when I was the punchline. That first summer with our convertible and the wind in our hair, we drove to the south of France. Roof down, sun on our skin, long lunches by the beach, we even went nude. Why not? Sally didn't care. Most of the time she went topless on the beach without a second thought. She had this confidence, a freedom that was infectious. On the way back, we got stuck in a traffic jam somewhere on the motorway in France. That's when we struck up a conversation with a Dutch couple in a Mercedes convertible beside us. Middle-aged, warm, relaxed. They told us their kids were grown, their business back home in Holland ran itself, and now they took off whenever they liked. Saint-Tropez this weekend, Fontainebleau the next. Would we care to join them? We did, and we made a vow, right there, sweating in traffic on the autoroute. Someday, we'd have our own business too. When our kids were grown, we'd travel the world together, just like them. And with that promise stitched into our hearts, we went home and started planning. A year later, the itch had become a burn. Orpington had grown too quiet, predictable. We were restless, hungry for more, so we took the leap, sold the house, said goodbye to certainty, and with trembling hands, we stepped into the unknown. We landed in Greenwich. There, on a sleepy corner, was a tired little shop with a one-bedroom flat above it. Nothing fancy. Most people wouldn't have looked twice. But to us, it was magic. A whisper of potential. A blank canvas waiting to be transformed. We named it Pistachio's Delicatessen, after my favorite nut. In the early days, there was no line between home and business. We lived in the shop, slept in the noise, woke to the roar of delivery vans, and fell asleep to the steady hum of the fridges downstairs. It was madness, but it was ours. We carved a home from its bones, hacking out a life upstairs and chasing a dream below. We'd bought a delicatessen called G.J. Plum, Sally's dream. It had a basement, and that was mine. I pictured a little Bakari restaurant down there. Simple pasta, honest wine, the hum of conversation, a cozy, candle-lit hole in the wall like you'd find in Venice. That was the plan. We'd run the deli together, side by side. I didn't know a thing about food, other than I liked eating it. But I adored the energy of wine bars, the laughter, the clink of glasses, the easy charm. I thought, how hard could it be? Then life intervened. Just as Sally was about to hand in her notice at the bank, they offered her a pay rise, more than double her current salary. A no-brainer. She had to take it. She stayed on at the bank, promising to help at weekends. So, I was left to run the shop solo during the week. The deli at first was an alien world. Customers would stroll in and ask for things I'd never heard of. "Do you sell pitted prunes?" one asked. "Pitted what?" I'd panic, duck behind the counter, and ring Sally at work. "Do we sell pitted prunes? If we do, where the hell are they?" She'd laugh down the line and calmly guide me to the shelf where they sat, probably glaring at me with their wrinkled little faces. We stocked over 100 cheeses. English, French, Italian, Dutch, German, Greek, 2-year matured cheddar, nutty red Leicester, crumbly Wensleydale. When the Wensleydale started turning blue, I didn't bin it. I rebranded it as Aged Blue Wensleydale and upped the price. People lapped it up. We had Brie de Meaux, Camembert, Roquefort, Bleu d'Auvergne, Halloumi, Feta. The shop smelled like a French village in summer. I fell in love with the cheeses. Eventually, I got us an off-license and started selling wine. Decent stuff too, French, German, Italian, estate wines. Bottles with stories, bottles that paired with everything in the shop. When Sally became pregnant with Ben, she finally took maternity leave. But even then, she couldn't sit still. Right up until the birth, she worked by my side. And just days after Ben arrived, she was back in the kitchen. Not because she had to, but because she loved it. She transformed the deli with her cooking. Her quiches, pies, samosas, and boreks became local favorites. She whipped up her own garlic mayonnaise, potted and labeled like a pro. Her coronation chicken had people queuing up. She even prepared full dinner party meals for customers to serve at home. But every lesson was a hard one. We had no clue about margins. Perishables betrayed us daily. Fruit turned, greens wilted, mold crept in before anything hit the counter. Money bled from every corner, but we kept going, powered by sheer will and each other. And in the eye of the storm, I brought home a surprise, a floppy-eared old English sheepdog puppy. We named him Bramble. He was a cloud of joy padding through the chaos, soft and daft and full of love. Then came the moment everything changed. One sleepless night, surrounded by empty crates, spoiled produce, and the silent hum of loss, the truth hit me. Perishables were the problem. They turned faster than we could sell them. But dried whole foods, nuts, grains, oils, they didn't. They had shelf life. They had margins. They had potential. I started dealing directly with importers. Pistachios that retailed for 99p per 100 grams, I could buy them for 25p per 100 grams. That was the pivot. We shifted the model. Bulk buying. Less waste. Better margins. Suddenly the numbers started to work. Slowly, the shop began to breathe. And just like that, things changed. We changed. But Greenwich gave us more than profit. It gave us people. Enter Slim Jims. Tucked nearby was a no-nonsense training spot with sweat-stained mats and a reputation. That's where I first saw Lenny McLean, the governor, a living legend, a brawler, a protector, a paradox, gentle with kids, fearsome in a fight. One day, after a brutal workout in the gym, I was toweling off in the changing room when I noticed the sauna crammed with bodies in the corner. Steam billowing out with every door swing, curious, cocky, feeling like I had something to prove. I strode right in, climbed up to the top bench, like I owned the place. Big mistake. The second I sat down, the heat slammed into me like a freight train. My lungs felt like they were inhaling fire. Sweat sprang instantly, running in hot rivulets down my back. My skin felt like it was being seared. My heart pounded so hard it rattled my ribs like a war drum. Every nerve screamed at me to get out. But pride had its grip on me. No way was I going to be the first one to break. So I sat there, pretending calm, while every second stretched like an eternity. Finally, I heard it, a low groan, the shuffle of someone caving. Someone else cracked first. That was my cue. I stood up, head held high, and followed him out like it was nothing. We made for the showers. That's when the final trial hit. I turned the tap and the ice water exploded over me. It punched the breath right out of my chest. My entire body seized. I genuinely thought I was going to black out, the cold slicing so deep it felt like knives. Behind me I heard it, booming laughter. Lenny and the lads, roaring with glee at the sight of me flinching, cursing, gasping for air. But even through the humiliation, something shifted. Because I hadn't run first, I hadn't tapped out. And in that moment, I saw it in their eyes. A flicker of something like respect. Because I didn't back down. Through Slim Jims, I became close with Brian, the owner, and eventually with Lenny himself. They started popping into Pistachios for sandwiches. I gave them discounts. They got us VIP entry into Camden Palace. It was an unspoken pact, a streetwise exchange of favors. Then came the night that changed how I saw Lenny forever. The Yorkshire Grey in Eltham, South London. Word spread that Lenny had a bare-knuckle fight lined up against a gypsy prize fighter. I went along, the pub packed and pulsing with anticipation, smoke thick in the air, tension hanging heavy. And then Lenny stepped into the ring. What unfolded was savage, unrelenting. The man I knew vanished. In his place stood a feral force, biting, stomping, mauling. The crowd roared with bloodlust. His opponent didn't stand a chance. Blow after brutal blow, Lenny dismantled him. By the end, the man was unrecognizable, slumped in a pool of blood. Everyone cheered. I didn't. I couldn't. It wasn't a fight, it was a reckoning. And in that moment, something inside me shifted. I saw what Lenny was truly capable of. Not just fists, but fury. That duality, the warmth and the wrath, haunted me. From then on, I stayed close, but careful. You don't provoke a lion, even if it once let you scratch its ears. Back at Pistachio's, things got stranger still. One ordinary afternoon, the door to our little corner shop swung open, and in walked a legend. Not the Hollywood type, though the stories that followed could have fooled you. No, this was Malcolm Hardy, infamous comedian, pub philosopher, and the anarchic ringmaster of South London's wildest comedy haunt, the Tunnel Club. Chaos in human form. Behind him shuffled a ragtag entourage, his tall, quiet mate Martin Potter with a glint of curiosity in his eye, Malcolm's wife Pip, and their scruffy, wide-eyed kids. It should have been a brief encounter, a customer, a hello, maybe a laugh, but within moments something clicked, like a match flaring to life. Martin wandered toward the deli, drawn like a moth to flame by the dangling strings of smoky cabanos. He nibbled without hesitation, as if the shop were his pantry, then turned with a sheepish smile and asked, "So, what do I owe you?" I laughed and fired back, "I don't know, how much did you weigh before you came in?" That was Martin, a man who disarmed you not with charm, but with a kind of grounded magic, effortlessly generous, inherently fascinating. He was from Eltham by postcode, but lived as though born at sea. You could see it in the way he stood, shoulders squared by waves, eyes always looking past the horizon. His father served in the Navy during World War II, following in the footsteps of his own father, who had fought in World War I. Stationed in Malta, Martin's grandfather met a young nurse at one of those elegant military dances, a chance encounter that blossomed into love and eventually marriage. From that union, a legacy was born. Carrying the weight of that proud tradition, Martin enlisted in the Royal Navy straight out of school, dedicating 6 remarkable years to service. But what came after? That was the stuff of myth. He became the skipper of Prince Rainier of Monaco's royal yacht. Yes, that Rainier. Yes, that Grace Kelly. Martin wasn't just the captain. He was their confidant, their watchdog, their friend. The way he told it, you'd think he was spinning tales. He painted pictures with words, but you'd look into his eyes and know it was all true. One moment we were anchored off Saint-Tropez. Rainier was crouched behind a pair of binoculars, scanning the beaches for topless sunbathers, nudging Martin with the glee of a naughty schoolboy, whispering, "What do you think of that one?" Another moment, it was a lavish party on deck. A-listers, royalty, champagne pouring like fountains. Martin stood at the entrance like a bouncer in pressed whites. A sharply dressed man approached. "I'm David Niven," he said smoothly. Martin checked the list. "Not on it." "I am David Niven." "Still not on the list." Minutes later, Grace Kelly appeared in a whirl of laughter, took Niven by the arm, and led him on board like he was family. By midnight, Martin and the Hollywood icon were side by side, trading tales like two old salts in a dockside pub. That was Martin, unflappable, principled, and always, always charming without effort. But Monaco wasn't the end of the story. The sea still called to him. He bought an old, broken ship, rotting in the forgotten harbor of Benalmadena, Spain. She was more bones than boat, barely afloat. But Martin saw what no one else could. He brought her back to England and breathed life into her, plank by plank, nail by nail, until she stood proud again, moored near Greenwich, a testament to the stubborn romance of dreamers. He kept a smaller vessel beside her, too, his racing girl. Every summer he'd set sail across the North Sea, alone, just him and the wind. Sometimes he invited us into that world. Fred, Martin, and I, 3 friends cut from different cloth, sailing together like brothers. We drifted through conversations that only the sea allows. Deep ones, honest ones, the kind that get into your bones. We drank, we laughed, we sailed through storms and silence alike. One year we journeyed to Malta, not for pleasure but pilgrimage, to trace the steps of Martin's grandfather, to honor that war-scarred love story, to walk where his story began. From behind the counter of a humble corner shop to the decks of royal yachts, from market fights to Mediterranean sunsets, life in Greenwich reshaped us. We didn't just change our postcode, we changed our entire sense of self. We were introduced to giants, some with fists, some with jokes, some with ships full of dreams and hearts full of stories. We built something from nothing, and that something became a doorway into a world we never knew existed. And to think, it all began with a string of Cabanos, a quiet man from Eltham, and the outrageous belief that something more was possible. Malcolm Hardy didn't just walk into a room. He crashed into it like a human Molotov cocktail of chaos, charm, and sheer bloody-minded mischief. He was the sort of man who seemed less born and more conjured, equal parts prankster god and drunken prophet of anarchy. If you knew him, you had a story. If you didn't, he'd give you one by the end of the night. And if you were lucky, or unlucky enough, to be at the Tunnel Club in its heyday, you knew that Malcolm didn't so much run it as unleash it nightly, like a circus without a ringmaster, just a gleeful arsonist holding the match. He drank like he was trying to drown a demon, smoked like the filter had done him wrong, and had an open relationship with cocaine, occasional, erratic, and wholly unapologetic. His legendary naked balloon dance, performed with nothing but inflated latex clinging to his flesh like a poor man's loincloth, had seared itself into comedy folklore. Dropping his trousers mid-set was less a stunt and more a punctuation mark. But beneath the wreckage he left in his wake was a strange tenderness. If he liked your set, he'd press a crumpled tenner into your hand like it was a golden ticket. If he thought your family was hungry, he'd feed the lot of you without a word. He was the kind of rogue who stole from the establishment and gave back in pork pies and punchlines, a walking contradiction, a lovable menace. Then there was that story, the one that floated around green rooms and backstage bars, always half-whispered with a grin. A tale so outrageous it had to be fiction, except it wasn't. The Queen incident. Yes, that Queen. Wembley Stadium. Lights, thunder, and rock royalty. Malcolm had somehow wrangled a booking to perform at a private after-party for the band, specifically his infamous balloon act. But on arrival, a slick-suited member of the entourage asked for a postponement. No problem, they said. Come back tomorrow. Same time, same place. So Malcolm returned the next evening, ready to let it all hang out, literally. Only this time, the mood had changed. The act was canceled. Sorry, mate. But don't worry, you'll still get paid. For any other performer, that would have been the end of it. A shrug, a drink, and a cab home. But this was Malcolm Bloody Hardy. And that's when he saw it. Standing in the middle of the backstage area, like some gluttonous monolith to excess, was a 6-foot birthday cake on wheels. Pink icing, gold trim, tiers stacked like royalty. It had been made specially for Freddie Mercury himself, who was meant to slice it with flair in front of adoring fans. Malcolm, eyes glinting with mischief and opportunity, made a decision in an instant. He wheeled the thing, slowly, absurdly, right out of Wembley, into his van, then drove the entire sugary colossus back to Greenwich as if it were the most natural thing in the world. Hours later, the knock came. Two officers stood at his door, shifting uncomfortably. They didn't want a fuss. They wanted the cake. Now, Malcolm, feigning confusion with that trademark smirk, denied everything. Cake? What cake? But the police weren't playing. Charges were on the table. Jail was mentioned. But then a lifeline. Return it. No harm done. There was, however, one small issue. How the hell had he gotten it inside? What they didn't realize, and what Malcolm wasn't about to tell them, was that behind the thick velvet curtains in his living room were large double patio doors, wide enough to accommodate a piano, or say, a Freddie Mercury birthday cake on casters. Still, negotiations began, and in the end there was only one logical outcome. The officers brought knives and began slicing up the massive confection right there in Malcolm's front room, piece by piece, until it could be ferried out like evidence from the world's weirdest crime scene. The cake made it back to Wembley. And Freddie? Rumor has it he never found out who nicked his cake. But everyone in the comedy world knew. That was Malcolm Hardy, equal parts Houdini, Highwayman, and Holy Fool. Always one step from disaster and two ahead of the law. While Crofty held the fort in East Greenwich, Sally and I made what we thought was a masterstroke, opening a second deli in central Greenwich. Two shops, double the revenue, prestige, presence. That was the plan. But Central Greenwich wasn't built on regulars. It was built on tourists, camera-wielding wanderers looking for fast coffee, sandwiches to go, anything they could carry while they ticked off landmarks. We weren't that. We were a deli built on care, flavor, and slow enjoyment. And the rent? Punishing. The weekday trade? A trickle. It became clear quickly that we'd misjudged. But this time, we didn't go down with the ship. We cut our losses, stripped it back, and started again. We pivoted hard, sleek, stylish, sharp. Out went the deli counters. In came artisan baguettes, torpedo rolls packed with smoked salmon and cream cheese, and silky lattes pulled from gleaming espresso machines. Something that wouldn't be out of place in the city. A Burley's with edge. Eva, our au pair, stepped in to help. And Steve Charlesley, close friend and full-time chief mechanic to race car driver Richard Piper, pitched in where he could. His obsessive precision brought a discipline to everything we touched. We weren't just creating food, we were curating an experience. In the back garden, we erected a marquee lined with powerful heaters. It transformed into a year-round haven. And it worked. Oh, how it worked. Weekends went wild, the place was buzzing, queues snaked out the front door, curling past the Mexican restaurant next door. Time Out featured us. Cosmopolitan, too. Suddenly, we were the Greenwich Cafe everyone was talking about. Our staff, mainly dancers from the nearby Laban Center, brought performance to the floor. They served with flair, style, and drama. Then there was Scott, unforgettable, theatrical Scott, who rewrote Oliver just for us. Food, glorious food, hot brie and custard, while we're in the mood, smoked salmon with cream cheese. It was electric. It was magic. It was madness. But the magic dimmed Monday through Friday. Tourism dried up in winter. Locals passed us by. We were busy on weekends, but weekdays became a slog. The owner of the Mexican restaurant confided in us. Everyone relied on weekends and summer trade to survive. But we didn't want to survive. We wanted a business that thrived all year round. That's when the idea struck. If they wouldn't come to us, we'd go to them. I walked into Young's Cycle Shop in Lewisham and commissioned a black mountain bike. Wicker baskets on the front and rear. Custom frame sign. Pistachios. Delivery was the future, and we were about to ride straight into it. Every morning, I loaded it with fresh sandwiches, drinks, and pedaled through Greenwich, hitting offices one by one. Greenwich Council on Evelyn Street was my favorite stop. I sold out every single day. Then one afternoon, Sally rang me in a panic. "Get back here, now." The customers I'd courted on my rounds were showing up in person. They wanted more. They wanted us. Weekday trade exploded, and just like that, Pistachios wasn't just surviving, it was thriving. The timing was serendipitous. Local restaurateur Ramsey had warned us early on that winter weekdays in Greenwich were dead, but our cafe defied the trend. It thrived. As business grew, we expanded our team. One standout was Angie, a dependable single mom with a radiant daughter named Stephanie. Angie quickly rose through the ranks, eventually managing the cafe alongside her sister and mother. They ran it like clockwork. To this day, I wonder what became of them. They were among the best staff I've ever known. We loved bringing creative energy into our daily grind. One summer, Mike and I devised a World Cup sandwich gimmick. Each time a country was knocked out, we'd retire a sandwich named after it. Roast beef vanished when England was knocked out of the tournament. Brie and Camembert disappeared with France. No signs, no explanation, just quiet rebellion. It became a game. Another marketing stroke of mischief was our daily soup riddle. One day's puzzle read, SE4 in English blue. A plumber's mate, a red Indian poison. The answer, broccoli and Stilton, potato and leek. When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, lentil be, as customers guessed and laughed, and ultimately bought bowls. It was a wild, thriving little world. Punctuated by unexpected visits from Malcolm, who had become a cafe regular. He adored Sally's soups. I remember one morning in particular, Malcolm was quietly slurping from a bowl when his mother appeared at the door. Without missing a beat, Malcolm looked up and bellowed, "Fuck me, ain't you dead yet?" We were mortified. She wasn't. She asked for a cigarette, lit it, and asked for another. Shortly after that bizarre breakfast reunion, Malcolm made us an offer. He needed catering for his soon-to-open comedy club, Up the Creek. I asked when it was opening. "This weekend," he shrugged. Apparently, the club couldn't legally serve alcohol without also serving food. So just like that, without much warning or plan, we found ourselves in the comedy business. It was one more surreal turn in a story that seemed to twist and tumble forward on its own momentum, no matter what we thought we were steering. From nicked cakes and stolen jobs to reinvented torpedo rolls and that ridiculous sandwich bike rattling through Greenwich, our life there was anything but simple. It was messy, chaotic, exhilarating, but it was alive. Truly, deeply alive in a way I'll never forget. And in the middle of it all was Malcolm, mad, generous, unstoppable Malcolm, who saw opportunities no one else did, who lit up a room with his laugh, who refused to let any of us stand still for long. One of those rare, unforgettable spirits who didn't just pass through your life, but carved their initials on it. And for better or worse, we let ourselves get swept along. Because that was Greenwich. That was us. I turned to Mike Croft, our friend, an employee, and the unmistakable lead singer of the Jiven Instructors, for help. Sally and I were regulars at his gigs, the smoky jazz clubs of South London, our usual haunt, where nights drifted away in the sultry pulse of brass and rhythm. Crofty was more than a local legend. He was a small-town star with a storied past. As a child, he'd been a TV actor, appearing on the iconic kids' show The Tomorrow People, but the spotlight called him elsewhere, into music. He became the charismatic frontman of a band that won hearts far beyond London, amassing a devoted following in Eastern Europe. Among their most faithful fans was an Irishman named Murphy, a lanky figure with long, greasy hair, a chipped tooth that flashed whenever he grinned, and an ankle-length black leather trench coat that became his signature. His thick Irish brogue echoed unmistakably wherever he went. Murphy hailed from a privileged Southern Irish family, whose pub and restaurant flourished under the careful watch of his parents and brother. He was engaged to his longtime sweetheart, but fate had a cruel twist in store. When Murphy's father died suddenly from a heart attack, he returned home to grieve, bringing his fiancée with him. The funeral was a somber affair, yet the days that followed grew heavier. Murphy found himself stranded, forced to stay longer to help run the family business. His fiancée, trapped in a life she never chose, couldn't adapt, and soon left for the UK, ending their engagement. Broken and adrift, Murphy's mother and brother, desperate to save him from sinking into despair, handed him £1,000 cash, his ticket to chase after her. The night he showed up at our cafe in Greenwich, Crofty was the only one Murphy wanted to see. Word had reached him that his ex-fiancée was now working at the Brixton Academy. With cash in hand, Murphy convinced Mike to accompany him there, promising to cover all expenses. At the academy that night, the air was thick with tension. Mike sipped beer from the sidelines, watching as Murphy approached the woman who had once been everything to him. The reunion was a powder keg waiting to explode. Moments later, she flung up her arms, snatched Murphy's beer, and dumped it over his head before storming away in fury. Mike approached Murphy, placing a steady hand on his shoulder, murmuring the same old refrain. "Let it go, mate. Plenty of fish in the sea. Let's get out of here." They returned to Greenwich. Murphy dropped Mike off, assuring him he'd be fine, then vanished into the night. It would be 3 months before Mike saw Murphy again. By then, Murphy had fled Ireland entirely. Haunted by loss and heartache, Murphy remembered an uncle who ran a bar in Paris. Clutching his remaining cash, he decided to escape everything and start anew in the City of Lights. Picture this. Murphy, reeking of beer, hair slicker than ever, trench coat trailing behind him, stepping off the ferry at Dover. The UK was on edge. IRA tensions flared, peace talks precarious. Customs officers zeroed in on him, suspicious of the cash he carried and his ragged appearance. Hours of grilling followed until, grudgingly, they let him go. Paris arrived like a dream, and then a nightmare. Night deep, no word from his uncle, Murphy roamed the streets in search of shelter. A grimy, all-night bar in a rough neighborhood provided temporary refuge and a few drinks. But as he left, two shadows trailed him into an alley. At knife point, they stripped him bare, stealing every possession. Naked and trembling, Murphy was abandoned to the biting cold. One of the attackers, perhaps moved by pity, tossed back his trench coat as they vanished. Barefoot, disoriented, wrapped in nothing but that heavy black coat, Murphy stumbled through freezing streets until the police caught him. They'd had reports of a flasher in the area. Seeing Murphy, disheveled and exposed, they were certain they'd found their man. Arrested on the spot, Murphy tried to explain. His thick accent and lack of French made it impossible. Only after a call to his uncle was the misunderstanding cleared up. Released without charge, he was sent to a local hostel for the night. Exhausted, Murphy shared a room with a stranger. He told his story, and the man raised an eyebrow, asking if Murphy was gay, given the neighborhood's reputation. Murphy, still reeling, assured him he wasn't, recounting his recent engagement instead. Sleep was short-lived. Awakened by the strange sensation of warm breath on his thigh, Murphy looked down to see his blanket yanked away, the coat open, and his roommate leaning over, licking his leg. Shocked and furious, Murphy threw him off and fled into the cold Parisian night. Eventually, Murphy found his uncle, who took him in and offered work at the bar. He stayed in Paris for 3 months before returning to London, where he recounted his 24-hour nightmare to Mike. Crofty, the consummate storyteller, spun Murphy's misadventures with such flair that we laughed until tears ran down our faces. It was Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, but with more beer, knives, and unexpected romance. Meanwhile, back home, Greenwich was buzzing with something electric. The grand opening of Up the Creek wasn't just a local event. It was a full-blown spectacle. Malcolm, ever the showman, had pulled every string, called in every favor. The place pulsed with expectation, as though the building itself knew it was about to become hallowed ground for British comedy. Headlining that night was none other than Squeeze, South London's own, the band whose lyrics had become the heartbeat of a generation. The guest list sparkled like a West End marquee, a roll call of British showbiz royalty. Jules Holland swept in with the swagger of a man who owned the room, while Johnny Vegas barreled through the crowd, his booming laugh ricocheting off the walls like a friendly cannon blast. Upstairs, in the private suite where the real party simmered, Malcolm had turned to Sally with a request that carried weight. "Can you cater for the band and their guests?" It was short notice, the kind of challenge that would make most people panic, but not Sally. She worked like an artist, assembling a spread that sang in harmony with the night's energy. From her own recipes came bowls of creamy, tangy homemade coleslaw, comfort food elevated to perfection. Platters of delicate canapés gleamed like edible jewels. Tapas dishes spilled over with color and spice, rich with Mediterranean flair. There were finger foods for those who wanted to graze, indulgent bites for the carnivores, elegant options for pescatarians, and vibrant, plant-powered creations for the vegans. No one was left out. It wasn't just catering, it was theater on a plate. Each dish carried a little of Sally's soul, resourceful, generous, quietly brilliant. By the time the first chords thrummed through the floorboards below, her feast was laid out like a banquet for kings, and the kings of British pop were about to devour it. The place was heaving with talent, noise, and the unmistakable crackle of something unforgettable taking root. Mike and I were in the thick of it. By day, I ran my cafe, serving cappuccinos and conversation, and by night, I was shoulder to shoulder with Malcolm and Crofty, steeped in the chaos and camaraderie of the club. Long hours? Absolutely. Exhausting? Without question. There was magic in the air. The famous drifted through like characters from another world. Vic Reeves, deadpan and surreal, floated in for a set. Lee Evans, an untamed hurricane under the spotlight, all sweat and manic energy, would shrink the moment the lights died, melting into the wallpaper with little more than a polite nod before vanishing like a ghost. Joe Brand, on the other hand, was a force of nature wherever she went. Razor-sharp wit on stage, wickedly funny off it, her presence magnetic. She had this teasing spark with Malcolm that kept us all grinning into our pints. But the real magic happened after hours, in those forbidden upstairs lock-ins, where time seemed to stop and the outside world ceased to exist. The shutters slammed down, the rules dissolved, and the night stretched out like an open road. Booze gushed like a broken tap, smoke curled thick and blue against the ceiling, and laughter roared until our throats burned. The carpet? It was a crime scene of spilled secrets, sticky with stories we swore would never see daylight. Those nights weren't just parties. They were living, breathing myths in the making. Then came that night. After a packed show that left everyone buzzing, someone whispered of an after-party in Westcombe Park, possibly Jules Holland's place, though no one could say for certain. No one ever could. The details were always smoke and mirrors when Malcolm was involved. Getting a cab was like summoning the devil, impossible, slow, and slightly cursed. The streets were gridlocked, horns blaring, tempers flaring. When one finally pulled up, Mike and I piled in, leaving Malcolm behind to lock up the club. We figured he'd be ages. But no more than 15 minutes after we arrived, a familiar swaggering silhouette crossed the garden threshold. Malcolm, smirking, windblown, radiating mischief. "How the hell did you get here so fast?" I asked. He leaned in, his breath boozy, eyes dancing. "Didn't get a cab," he said with a wink. "Borrowed a car." We blinked. "You what?" He nodded toward the window, and there it was, a police car. Jack knifed at the curb, driver's side door hanging open, blue light still lazily pulsing. A surreal flashing beacon of disaster. Apparently the officers had been called out on foot, rushed from the car mid-call, keys still dangling in the ignition. Malcolm, drunk and giddy, had strolled past, seen an opportunity, and, without so much as a second thought, slipped behind the wheel and driven himself to the party. Illegal, insane, utterly reckless, and yes, hysterically, absurdly Malcolm. Years passed. The club thrived. Malcolm, always half in the joke and half out to sea, eventually sold his stake and up the creek, and turned to a dream only he could have conjured. He bought a boat, moored it at Surrey Quays, and christened it the Wibbly Wobbly. It doubled as a floating comedy venue and a boozy Noah's Ark for misfits and comedians. He also bought a houseboat to live on, tethered nearby. But even domestic life, in Malcolm's world, was a tightrope over absurdity. Most nights, half-cut and full of stories, he'd shimmy down a rope ladder from the Wibbly Wobbly into a little rowing boat, his means of ferrying himself home across the murky Thames. And often, inevitably, he'd miss his step, tumble into the river, claw his way out soaked and swearing, then row on like nothing had happened. It was funny, until it wasn't. In 2005, after another long drunken night, Malcolm didn't make it to the other side. He slipped into the water, alone in the dark, and didn't come up again. His body was found days later, tangled in the reeds, still, silent, as if the river itself had finally put a full stop on the life of the man who never stopped moving. His funeral at St. Alphage's Church in Greenwich was packed, a true send-off. Friends, fans, and celebrities filled the pews, tears fell, laughter echoed, stories poured like wine. It wasn't solemn, it was raucous, it was wild, it was exactly what he would have wanted. And later, at the wake in the Trafalgar, we raised our glasses to the King of Chaos, to Malcolm Hardy, the man who could steal a police car and your heart in the same night. He lived like a firecracker, and when he finally burned out, he lit up the sky. Sally's culinary skills never went unnoticed. What started as a little side hustle soon became a quiet storm of reputation. She had a way of transforming simple ingredients into dishes that tasted as though they carried entire histories within them. Customers would arrive with empty platters in hand, waiting for Sally to crown them with her homemade creations. Quiches so rich and buttery they melted on the tongue, decadent chocolate cakes that disappeared slice by slice, and her legendary carrot cake, a recipe so perfected it almost had a cult following. Some customers, we suspected, passed off her handiwork as their own, spinning little white lies at dinner parties. "Yes, I made it myself," they'd say, as their guests devoured every last crumb. Sally, in the shadows, their culinary ghostwriter. Her reputation spread beyond the neighborhood, eventually landing in the grand halls of a grand apartment within Vanbrugh Castle, perched on Maze Hill, Greenwich's imposing answer to a French fortress village. The apartment was home to a travel writer of some renown, and her partner, a high-ranking diplomat, soon to be stationed in the Middle East. For their farewell, they wanted something special, a banquet that could marry the spices of the Orient with the refinement of the English table. Sally was in her element. She conjured a feast that could have graced the table of a Persian prince or found approval in Buckingham Palace, a shimmering spread of Middle Eastern delicacies interwoven with classic English fare. The hosts were spellbound. The travel writer was so moved, she dedicated a small write-up to Sally in her next book, a tribute I sorely wish I'd kept, a memento of her brilliance, proof forever of her quiet triumph. Not long after, our little cafe found itself at the heart of another unexpected spectacle. Members of Britain's comedy elite, John Cleese, Lenny Henry, Robbie Coltrane, Ade Edmondson, and Jennifer Saunders, descended on Vanbrugh Castle to prepare for a forthcoming policeman's ball. One afternoon, they slipped away from their rehearsals and ducked discreetly into our café, choosing the marquee in the back garden for lunch. Word traveled fast. By the time the first plates landed, the secret was out, and our little queue stretched out the door. Still, fame was no passport to privilege under our roof. Our system was simple. Everyone queued. No exceptions. Rachel, one of our waitresses from the Laban Center, nearly fainted when she saw Jennifer Saunders politely shuffled to the back of the line, waiting her turn like everyone else. "I can't believe you made Jennifer Saunders queue," she whispered, wide-eyed, as though I'd committed high treason. But that was our way, fair and square even for the stars. From memory, they were all delightful, warm, witty, easy to serve. Lenny Henry, ever the gentleman, did request, half-joking, half-serious, that we turn off the music in the marquee so they could eat in peace. And so we did. Looking back now, the whole scene feels surreal, like a play within a play. Comic royalty lining up for quiche and carrot cake in our garden, laughter spilling between bites, and Sally's cooking the quiet star of the show. Fred Harding didn't just arrive. He was ushered into my life by fate, wearing a Crystal Palace scarf and Crofty's grin. The two of them were season ticket stalwarts, bound by shared heartbreaks and fleeting glories on the terraces of Selhurst Park. Me, I was claret and blue to the bone, a North Bank boy through and through, roaring myself hoarse at Upton Park, shoulder to shoulder with strangers who became brothers in the crucible of Saturday afternoons. I'm forever blowing bubbles. It wasn't just a song, it was scripture. Every Monday morning became its own kind of sacred. Three men. Two rival teams. An endless river of steaming coffee, keeping the blood hot and the banter hotter. Me, Fred, and Crofty, tearing into each other with merciless jibes, laughter cracking like gunfire, sharp but never cruel. Beneath it all ran a current of loyalty, the kind of affection you can't fake. This wasn't just talk, it was ritual. It was our church, our release. Fred wasn't just a mate. He was the kind of man who left fingerprints on everything he touched, literal and otherwise. A decorator by trade, but in truth, an artist disguised in paint-stained overalls. He had a craftsman's soul, an eye that could transform the ordinary into the elegant. His work caught the attention of Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen himself, but to us, he was just Fred, the one you trusted with your walls, your cupboards, your chaos. He didn't just decorate our house, he became part of it. Our kids grew up side by side, birthdays, dinners, scraped knees, shared holidays. Our families stitched themselves together like patchwork. It was one of those rare friendships that grows quietly until one day you realize it's built into the very foundations of your life. Those were the golden years. Pistachios was thriving, our little empire growing one sandwich at a time.